Good morning. It's great to be with all of you this morning. Barry, in an interesting turn of events last week, announced to the class that I was teaching this morning. And that was when you found out, and that was also when I found out. So that was great. It's really hard to say no, though, if someone does it that way. I don't know if that was his intent or not, but anyway, if you'll turn to Romans chapter 9, or really you can just turn to chapter 10, and we're going to go back a verse or two to start this morning. So last week we got through, I would say, half of the section that's the very end of chapter 9 and the very beginning of chapter 10. So we're going to do a little bit of review or discussion as we start kind of going through the next part of chapter 10 this morning. So as you look at this, I want to pose a question or two, if that'll work. All right. So in front of you, you have chapter 9, verses 30, 10 through 4. It's from the ESV. You're welcome to use your own Bible if you'd like. My question first is, in verses 1 through 3, Paul uses the word they or them, I think, six times. I've highlighted those, if you can see that at the end. Who is they or them in this section? If you want to take a minute and just read that section, you're welcome to. If you happen to have a thought about who they or them could be, feel free to shout it out. Okay, so it could be Israel or the Jews, either one. What else? There's at least one other option. Gentiles, right? Like, as you read the Romans, there's a lot of times when you have a choice about what it's talking about, and most of the time that choice is either it's talking to Jews or it's talking to Gentiles. So those are the choices. Who do you think they is when Paul says, "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved, for I bear witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." Who do you think they is? Jews. Why would you say that, Mr. Hooten? So if you couldn't hear him, Mr. Hooten said the next section that we're going to get to in Romans 10, Paul is really focused on his Jewish brethren. So that's an argument that they is Israel or Jews. If you look before this, what would your argument be that it's Jews? Michael?
I guess I'm just looking at the flow of grammar, and it says, "But that Israel sued a law that would lead to righteousness." He never talks about the Gentiles again.
He
just keeps saying, "They."
Yeah. If this is really annoying me that it's not working as I would like, this is going to be a problem in class. So he says, "But that Israel," and then he keeps using "they." So I think there's actually a really strong grammatical argument, which I'm not one for often making pure arguments based off of the grammar, partly because grammar changes from Latin to Greek to English. But here he says, "But that Israel," and then he keeps going and he says, "They did not pursue it by faith. They have stumbled over the stumbling stone." There's this quotation that we looked at last week about the stumbling stone. And then he keeps going into "they" and "them" and talking about their salvation. If we look for another theme in this part or this section, this is going to be really a problem. If you want to get it for me. So the next kind of word or idea that's repeated a lot is righteousness. I counted "they" and "them" six times in 1 through 3. It's really like 9 times if you look at the full section. And now righteousness is used multiple times as well. But specifically, I want to talk about this concept of the righteousness of God or God's righteousness. What do you think the righteousness of God means here? And I ask that because we would all describe God as righteous. That's not a, of course God is righteous sort of statement. But what does Paul mean here when he says the righteousness of God? Would you say, Ms. Pat? Did you have a thought? No. Can you think of another passage in Romans when the righteousness of God is discussed frequently?
Well, not the answer to that question.
Oh, well, okay.
But the righteousness of God is being acceptable to God.
So
and it's something that he determines.
Okay. So Chip's point is the righteousness of God here is about us attaining to the Father's righteousness and that he provides a path to that? Is that, did I misstate your point?
It's like what he said about Abraham, he was declared righteous because of his faith.
So Abraham was declared righteous by his faith. So Chip, when you say the righteousness of God here, you're making this about the believer. I think this is describing God. Okay, so when he uses it to describe God here, I think we can understand this better if we look at Romans chapter 3. So if you'll turn back a couple chapters and go to chapter 3 and verse 21. I'm going to read 3:21 through 26. As I do that, I want you to notice the times that God's righteousness is mentioned, and we'll talk about that a minute after I'm done reading. Romans 3, verse 21, "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift, through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood, to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time, so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus." I count four mentions here of the righteousness of God. I see the first one in verse 21. How's the righteousness of God described in verse 21?
The righteousness of God made known apart from the law.
All right. So verse 21, it's made known apart from the law. What's the next time that the righteousness of God is mentioned? Through faith. So in verse 22, through faith for all who believe. Now this third one's a little hard. It's a little bit harder, but I think we can get it. In verses 24 and 25, what's the point here of the righteousness of God?
Paid through Christ's blood.
It's paid through Christ's blood. Its redemption is through the blood of Christ Jesus. And then the last one is in verse 26, and what's the concept here of God's righteousness?
He could be righteous and make man righteous.
So he is righteous, and he can make man righteous. So in Paul's words, he uses this phrase I really like. We're going to try another one. And this is just all faith. So we're not going to use that. He uses these words I really, really like. Paul says that God is the just and the justifier. The concept of being just and the justifier is really, really important to this next section in Romans chapter 10 we're going to talk about. The righteousness of God is that he promised a path to salvation, but in order for that salvation to be possible, he had to make it possible for our sins to be forgiven. He is just in that he holds men accountable for sin. But he's the justifier in that he also provides a path to forgiveness of that sin. He can be both the just and the justifier for his people, which is extremely important to our salvation and for that of the Israelites as well. Any questions about that before we go back into Romans 10? Yeah, Chip.
The comment that, so what I was saying earlier, Brooke, I'm glad you brought that up, because what I was saying earlier, I was focusing on being the justifier.
Yeah.
And you bring up the other part of that passage that's so great, that he's also just in the way that he is the justifier.
Yeah.
So we have both righteousnesses of God. God's personally being just, and his personally, and his justifying, or declaring us righteous by faith.
Yes.
So since we have both in your example passage, help us see which one of the two, or is it both in Romans 10?
So we'll talk about that a little bit more in Romans 10. So we're going to end this section when we talk about Romans 10. We're going to conclude the class today talking more about the concept of Christ as the just and the justifier. So I'll either answer Dad's question at the end, or I'll not answer it and hope people forget. Yeah, exactly. You can hold me hostage at lunch. Yes, sir.
If you were to try to come up with one aspect of God, you'd probably come up with the word holy. He is holy, therefore he can't be anywhere associated with sin. Sin can't be in his presence. So since man, both Jew and Gentile, are sinners, he's got to find a way for him to be just. That means that he deals with sin, he punishes sin. But on the other hand, he has to have a way that he can make men as though they've never sinned and make them just. And that's through the propitiation of Jesus' blood. He's able to do both. He's able to be holy and yet still forgive sins.
He's able to be holy, and part of that concept of being just is that he does hold us accountable for sin. So when God is holy and he provides a path to salvation, it's not that he just says, oh, it's okay. That's fine. We'll just forget about that. If he did that, he would not be just. So in order for him to be just, he has to hold us accountable for sin. And we can be thankful that he does more than that. He also justifies us as well, so that we aren't held responsible at the end for our sin. He forgives us. All right, let's look at Romans 10. I'm going to read verses 5 through 13. For Moses writes about the righteousness that is based on the law, that the person who does the commandments shall live by them. But the righteousness based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend to heaven, that is, to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the abyss, that is, to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we proclaim. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. For the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. This section of Romans and the rest of chapter 10 are just really, really, really thick with comments or direct quotes from the Old Testament. There is really no way for us in a single class to look at all of those. It would take many class periods, I would assume, to understand the context of each of them. I counted between this section and the next, there's between 8 and 10 at least references to Old Testament prophecy and law that the full context is sometimes many, many chapters to get all of it. So I'm just going to tell you, we're not going to do all that this morning because we just don't have time for it. But I think this is one of those sections that's really important to establish what the point of the section is, and then maybe look at some of those Old Testament passages. So if you were going to look in this section, 5 through 13, what would you say is the point of the section?
Sir,
that justification comes to all, and there's something you need to do.
All right, there's justification comes to all, and there's something you need to do. Which verse would you say makes those points or verses?
Well, kind of the context of all of it, but everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame, for there's no distinction. So that's everyone.
That's verse 11. So that's one. Everyone who believes will not be put to shame, they'll be saved. So if we agree that that's the main point of this section, what other verses would say that also? In here. What'd you say?
13.
Yeah, verse 13. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. There's at least two other verses that make the same point. Conveniently, they're really close to the other one, so look around there. What's verse 9 say?
Eight says, the word is near you. It's according to who you is. Well, that's everybody. And then 9 says, if you confess with your mouth. So, who is you? He's talking to everybody.
All right. So, in verse 9, it says that God will provide salvation. And then in verse 10, kind of describes a little bit more how that's accessed. What do we do as a part of that salvation? Yeah, we confess. Everyone who believes and everyone who confesses. I would just point out, I don't think those are two completely separate acts. I think he's talking about one concept. They're believing and confessing together. I think the point of 5 through 13 is that God provides salvation. In a minute, we're going to go to Deuteronomy 30 and talk a little bit more about this reference he makes to Deuteronomy 30 that helps explain this a little bit more. But I think the point of this section is that God provides salvation. Any comments or questions about that, just at a high level? Yes, sir.
I kind of feel like sometimes we're missing the point. We're looking to this to see what we're doing in this whole section. You know what I mean? Like, there are certainly things that Paul spells out for us to do, but I don't think the point of it is what we do as much as you don't really do anything. It's God that does the doing.
Yeah, Michael, I think that's a great point. Look at verse 31 and 32 of chapter 9. I think he makes Michael's point in talking about Israel. But that Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching the law because they did not pursue by faith, but as if it were based on works. They have stumbled over the stumbling stone. So this is a concept that's stated in the negative, meaning they did not achieve the law or the commandment because of what? Because of the lack of faith. I personally have a real problem with negative concepts. Something didn't happen because of something. We can change this statement into a positive statement instead of a negative one. Which sometimes as parents, right, we fail here. We tell our children, don't do this thing, as opposed to telling them, do this thing. We have found that sometimes we're more successful when we tell them what to do instead of what not to do. So if we kind of restate 31 and 32 as a positive statement, What could we say about the Israelites? Alan, I can see you chewing on it.
Well, they did the actions of the law, but see, I can't make it law positive. They actually followed the law, but they didn't have it within their hearts. But that's not.
He doesn't say they followed the law. What does he say they did? They depended on work. So don't do that. Like, that's the negative thing to do. So what should they have done, Dad?
If Israel had pursued righteousness by viewing the law as a framework for serving God by faith, they would have attained righteousness. But instead, they pursued the law as being a way of achieving righteousness. So they failed.
Yes, they sought to achieve the law by their own work, by the sweat of their brow, in a way of saying that. Instead of what he says here, which is attaining to the law by faith. So if we change this into a positive statement, what I would say is the law could lead to righteousness if it was pursued by faith. So much of our study in Romans is about the need to turn from the law and works. And I think sometimes we can misunderstand what that means. First of all, we can misunderstand and think that means the law was bad. Thankfully, Galatians really clearly makes out that the law wasn't bad, it was good. The problem was that the Israelites, they focused on the law as something that if they were driven by obedience and physical adherence to the law, that they could be righteous. That is a perversion of the Old Testament law. Instead, the law was built on the concepts of faithfulness and devotion to God, not just strict requirements of physical obedience, and that would lead to attaining a relationship with God.
It's also a perversion to go the other way and say we don't need to do anything, and God's going to save us.
Right. Yeah, it is a perversion to say that all we have to do is say the Lord's Prayer and we're saved. By the same token, it is a perversion to think that if every time I pray, I don't remember to ask for God's forgiveness, that I'm stuck, that I am condemned. That's turning the idea of prayer and asking for God's grace into a work that leads to salvation. Chip.
It seems that to me things that the Israelites missed was grace, the concept of grace. They were trying to earn their salvation, and so they showed a lack of faith in the concept of grace. And Paul's making that very clear here in Romans, that it's by faith in the grace of God that causes you to behave a certain way, to try and emulate him, but because of your love and appreciation for that. But he's bringing that to the forefront that was missed in the Israelites.
Exactly. With that, let's turn back to Deuteronomy 30. Hold your place in Romans 10, or just remember how to get there. And let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 30. So in Romans 10, Paul quoted directly from multiple spots in the latter half of Deuteronomy 30. But I think this is one of those times it's important to remember that when Paul gives a few quick quotes about from the Old Testament, his goal is that we remember the whole context of those quotes. So if you were thinking about Deuteronomy and this section in Deuteronomy 30, if you thought about, say, chapters 27 and 28 and 29, what are those chapters of Deuteronomy about? The curses and the blessings. And that's a shorthand that we use to refer to, he said, if you serve me and if you love me, I'm going to bless you in all these wonderful ways. I think that's mostly in chapter 27. And then the cursings in chapter 28, if you don't obey me and if you don't love me, I'm going to do all these things to you. And then in chapter 29, they renew the covenant. And then in chapter 30, kind of returns to this idea of the blessing and the cursing. In verses 1 and 2 of chapter 30, when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the cursing, which I have set before you, you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you. So if you remember in the cursings, he talks about if they didn't serve the Lord, they'd be sent out. They'd be taken captive. And it's kind of interesting. He tells them, you can have these things, you can have these blessings if you serve me, you can have these cursings if you don't. And then he says, like, by the way, that's going to happen. Like, you're going to fall away, you're going to leave me, and I'm going to take you captive. That's how he starts chapter 30. But if you look in verse 2, what's the idea that starts to show up in verse 2?
Return to God.
You're going to come back.
Yeah. You're going to return to God, you're going to come back. And some of us might call that, we like to use this fancy term, restoration, right? You're going to be restored in your relationship to the Father. And in verses 3 through 6, he describes what that restoration is going to be like. What are some phrases or terms that you see in verses 3 through 6 that we actually also see in Romans?
Compassion.
Yeah, he'll have compassion on them. What else?
Gather you.
Yeah, he'll gather you, bring you together. What about in verse 6? He will circumcise your heart and the hearts of your offspring and turning them back to the Lord. He will make that possible for us when we serve him. And then look in verses 7 through 10, he kind of restates some of those blessings again. What are some of the things that they're told the Lord will do for them after this restoration?
Put the curses on their enemies.
Yeah, instead of cursing you, I'll curse your enemies. And what else is he going to do?
Make them prosperous.
Yeah, I'm going to make you prosperous. In verse 9, the Lord your God will make you abundantly prosperous in all your work of your hand, and the fruit of your womb, and in the fruit of your cattle, and the fruit of your ground. For the Lord will again take delight in the prospering of you, as he took delight in your fathers. This idea of the Lord will delight in you. What is that idea of the Lord delighting in them? What is that dependent on?
Their obedience.
Yeah, in verse 10, he kind of, you can see this in verse 2, and you can see it in verse 10. For him to restore them, they had to turn back to the Lord, and they had to call out to him. But then in verse 10, he again kind of reiterates this concept that when you obey the voice of the Lord to keep his commandments and his statutes, and when you turn to the Lord with all your heart and all your soul, the Father blessing them was dependent on their hearts turning back to God. So with that in mind, let's read verses 11 through 20. For this commandment that I command you today is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it? Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it? But the word is very near to you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you can do it. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, and by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. But if your heart turns away, and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are going to over the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life, that you and your offspring may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, and holding fast to him. For he is your life and length of days, that you may dwell in the land that Jacob swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. When I read, starting in verse 11, I'm struck by how different it is than what we usually think of when we talk about the law. Moses tells them that the commandment is not too hard. It is not far off. Usually when we talk about the Old Testament, how do we reference it? It's impossible to keep. It is too hard. That's why Jesus had to come, was because the Old Testament law was too hard to keep. Is that what Moses says? No, it's not what Moses says. He tells them it isn't impossible, and then he uses these references. It's not like someone has to go to heaven for you and bring it down. It's not like someone has to go across the sea. You don't have to go across the sea. You don't have to do some impossible thing to have access and to read it and to know what to do. So, I'm interested in your thoughts. How do we square this idea that we have, and lots of parts of the New Testament reference that the law was hard to keep? It was a problem for the people. Yet here Moses says it's not too hard. How do you square those
two ideas? It's impossible for us to keep it perfect.
Okay, Mr. Hooten says it's impossible for us to keep it perfectly. Absolutely. What else?
Verse 14. But the word is there near you, and it is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you can do it. So it has to be, you have to have the word in you to be able to do it.
So having the word in you, not it's just something that you're around or that's near you or that's in a book, it's near you, it's inside of you. Yes, Julie. So what Julie said, if you couldn't hear her, was that kind of remember what we just looked at in chapter 9 right before we went here. That you could either try to keep the law or attain the commandment by faith or by works. You have a choice. That when we talk about the law being impossible to keep, what we are talking about, what the New Testament writers are talking about, is that the law was impossible to keep from a place of works. It was impossible for me to do all of those things perfectly. Part of the way you can know that is if they were able to keep all of the law perfectly, there's at least one aspect of the law they would not have needed. What's that?
Sacrifice.
If they could keep all of the law perfectly, they'd have to have some sacrifices for the different like offerings at harvest time and those things, but specifically sacrifice for sin would be unnecessary if they could keep the law perfectly in terms of works. Instead, when it came time for sacrifice for sin, Jerusalem and the temple was like a slaughterhouse. They had to sacrifice over and over again because of their failure. The Hebrews would tell us that would be to remind them of their sin. Were you going to say something?
When Paul in Romans 10 quotes from Leviticus 18 and Deuteronomy 30, he's not suggesting that there is a
disagreement,
of course. He's simply borrowing Old Testament language to discourage a works-oriented approach to being righteous with God, as opposed to a faith-oriented approach. And I think one way we might be able to wrap our minds around that more easily is if we specialized our use of the word obey and obedience. As Paul uses that in Romans 10, as Deuteronomy uses it in Deuteronomy, as Moses uses it in Deuteronomy 30, obedience includes the concept of faith. Romans 1 and Romans 16 begin and end Romans talking about the obedience of faith. Let's not confuse obedience with compliance. No one can comply with the law sufficiently to please God, because we can't keep it perfectly, but because also God expects us to trust Him. He expects us to have faith. And so the works approach, whether you're talking about the law or the law of Christ, where we're thinking that if we just comply well enough, we'll be acceptable to God. It's a failed approach. It's doomed. But if we have an obedience approach, that we trust God, we love God, we're grateful to God, therefore we want to please Him. And so we strive to do what He says. Then as we trust Him from our hearts and confess our faith, we can be right with Him, whoever we are, by calling on the Lord in that way. What do you say?
And if you look in Deuteronomy 30, I think he makes this point twice. In verse 16, if you obey the commandment of the Lord your God that I command you today by loving the Lord your God, and then, and I'll tell you, I think this is a punctuation problem. I think that the right way to read this in our English grammar would be, if you obey the commandment of the Lord your God, that I command you today by loving the Lord your God, I think that's a colon after that. A comma is used in mine. I think it's more like the feel of a colon. That obeying the Lord's commandments is loving the Lord your God, colon, and then there are ideas he presents that are part of that. Walking in his ways, keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules. That all of those things after what I'm presenting is the colon, after the statement of love the Lord your God, those are things that describe loving the Lord your God, not love the Lord your God and obey him perfectly. Instead, love the Lord your God. And you see this again in verse 20. Loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice and holding fast to him. For he is your life and length of days, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. Amen. When I read verse 20, I think of a child. Judah is at my favorite age for a child. For those of you that are visiting, Judah is my third child. He is 2.5 years old, and it was my favorite age for the first two. And based on experience, it'll be my favorite age when Harmony's that age too. I love that age because at that time, everything in their life is new and fresh. Every bug needs to be chased or handled that they encounter, and every flower needs to be smelled, and every, for Judah, toy car needs to be played with. But what I love most about this age is coming home from work. And what I love is when I come in the back door through the garage, like lots of you enter our home, I usually whistle or say something. And from across the house, Judah will run as fast as he can, and he'll scream, "Daddy!" And he'll come up to me with his arms up, and he'll be unsatisfied until I pick him up and hold him and throw him in the air a little bit and give him a hug. And there is nothing in this world that warms my heart more and my soul than when he runs to me and yells daddy and wants nothing but to be held. And when Moses says that we obey his voice and hold fast to him, that idea is the idea of a child that when the voice of their father rings out, they know nothing but to run and hold their arms in the air. And that when they're hurting and they're in pain, the only thing they want to do is to hold on to their father or their mother and be held and showed care and love. Obeying his commandment is running to him and yelling, Abba, Father, and asking to be held and never wanting anything else. The Israelites failed because they thought that they needed to be perfect. But instead, God wanted them to run to him and cry out. And he would solve their imperfection. And he would hold fast to them just as they held fast to him. In Romans 9 and 10, I had great slides for this. I'm just going to tell you this next part I worked a lot on, so you're just going to have to imagine. Yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say that when you think about what you've just said about running to the Father, what do you want? Lord, give your Son up against going to them when you're in trials, tribulations. It makes you really understand how God really felt with the Israelites, and we today turn to other gods instead of him.
Cher's point is fantastic. And in fact, it's the only warning in this section. If you look at verse 17, but if your heart turns away and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them. God's warning is not that if they don't obey perfectly, he'll reject them, but that if they turn their back on him and go to serve other gods, that is what will lead to death and to punishment. In Romans 9 and 31 and 32, we made the point just before we went to this section that the law could lead to righteousness if it was pursued by faith and not works. And then in verses 1 through 4 of chapter 10, we talked about how the righteousness of God is that he provides a path to salvation. We made that point by going back to chapter 3. And then in verses 5 through 8 of Romans 10, he kind of references this section in Deuteronomy 30. And then the next verses, 9 through 13, we talked about how they kind of summarize as God provides salvation to all people. I think that third point that we just talked about that references back to Deuteronomy 30 is really important. And that is that the commandment was neither far off nor too hard for them. This concept does not imply that the task is easy. I think when you combine all of these four points, you could walk away with the idea that must mean that salvation is easy. And I think that would be a problem to understand it that way. Instead, we need to understand that Paul has presented these four points in this order to provide hope that salvation is not impossible. For example, the Israelites saw God literally rain down fire and brimstone on Egypt. They walked through the Red Sea on dry ground, and every morning when they woke up, there was food on the ground that they just had to pick up. Yet what did they do? They complained. We read about Massa and Meribah and how they cried out to the Lord and said, "We just wish we'd go back to Egypt. You just brought us out here to die." They saw all these physical ways that the Lord showed his love and his care for them, yet they still rejected him. But what did he do? He disciplined them because they fell away. He disciplined him like anyone would their children. But thankfully, he is both just, he disciplined them, and the justifier, and that he brought the remnant back and brought them back to Judea. It is his right to simply be just. But instead of simply being just, he justifies us. And when we are in a sad and sorry state of captivity, just like they were, he provides for our justification through Christ. His salvation is neither too hard for us, nor is it far off, because he is both just and the justifier. Thank you. That's all the time we have this morning.